Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan, and thank you for joining me for this 22nd edition of New Manners Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is Mansi Joshi. Mansi is originally from India and between the ages of 6 and 18, moved with her nuclear family to live in Singapore. Mansi is a mechanical engineer who studied and then worked in Indiana. Before heeding the call of the sea sirens, wanting to live near the coast, she found her way to Portland, Maine. Welcome to New Mainers Speak.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Great to have you. So when you were a child, it sounds like you experienced a major shift from your home in India, where you lived around an extended family, to a new life in Singapore with just your mother, father, and baby brother. That sounds like a pretty dramatic change. What caused your family to leave India, and can you tell us some of your earliest memories from India?
I guess what caused my family to leave India, my dad's an engineer, and so they went off in search of new opportunities. India of the 80s was a pretty hard place to live. There were a lot of people, not a lot of jobs. This was before the IT boom and all of the industrialization that followed. So my dad left. He was a chemical engineer, and he worked in oil refining. So he took the four of us, and we went off to Singapore so that he could have a better job and we could have better schools and other opportunities in life. I grew up in Mumbai, which was then called Bombay, and my earliest memories are running around the family home. It was a one-story house, which now that I'm a grown-up, I realize how rare it is to live in a house in a city like Bombay, which is full of skyscrapers. But we had a house. And we had neighbors, and I lived there with my grandparents and my parents, and my uncle and my brother hadn't been born yet. And it was my kingdom. I had five adults at my beck and call.
That's a good life.
I got to choose who would tell me a bedtime story. My uncle had the best stories, but he would fall asleep before he ended it.
Cliffhangers.
It was always a trade-off. And I ran around a lot, I guess. My parents, both my parents worked at the time, so it was my grandparents, and at some point I got to outrun them, so I was just one of those kids who ran around all around the house and on the street. It's hard to imagine now, but I didn't have a sense of danger. I'd run out on the street and chase after cars. I also didn't have a sense of there being germs. We'd play in the mud or in the dirt or just... no sense of this is dirty and this is not, which is very different now, I guess, when you look back at India and you think you were playing on those streets. I was. And I'd come home and my grandmother would practically hose me down. But I just remember not having any boundaries. You could do whatever you want. It was safe. You kind of moved as a pack with all the neighboring kids. We didn't have a lot of toys, so you came up with pointless games like hide and seek, or, you know, if you found a car tire, we'd roll it down the road, and just play silly games like that and just while away the afternoon. It seemed like time stood still and this was our kingdom.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Kind of a classic childhood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good childhood. Luxuries were rare, though. Now that I look back, I think my parents took me out for ice cream once a year. It's hard to imagine now that I managed to have ice cream only once a year. but it was a luxury in those days. I think we didn't get a refrigerator until I was five. We had a black and white television that my dad, it would break down. My dad would spend days fixing it.
At least he could, right?
Yeah.
How handy.
Yeah, so we didn't have a lot of luxuries, but I guess growing up, I didn't realize that those were things we were supposed to have. So
you had stories,
yeah,
and games and yeah, friends,
yeah,
and family. And you were raised in a Hindu tradition. How was that the same or different for your family when you moved to Singapore?
My family is very religious, and so moving to Singapore was a bit of a transition in the sense that not everybody around us celebrated the same festivals. Growing up in Bombay, there was a great sense of community, because if there was a festival, we'd celebrate it together with the neighbors. You'd just go over to people's houses. A lot of Indian festivals do involve visiting people and, bringing food, or not really gifts, mostly food.
Yeah.
And, just dressing up and going to visit and that sort of thing. And that was the hardest part, I think, for my parents, is not being surrounded by the community. Singapore is a great place for being of a different religion. And also, since it's an immigrant society to begin with, there were a lot of Hindu temples. And so my parents, of course, gravitated towards those. It wasn't difficult for them to practice our faith in Singapore. In fact, I think it might have been easier in some ways, because they could do it their way without, being in a joint family where they had to conform to the way my grandmother did things, my grandfather did things, so they could do their own thing. But I think this not having the community around was probably the hardest. And when we grew up, the families would get together on festivals like Diwali, which is a big Indian festival, and they'd attempt to recreate it for us kids. But in India, we'd have the streets full of fireworks. And of course, in Singapore, you don't have that. And we just barge into any of the neighbors' houses and eat snacks and then run around some more. And, we couldn't do that in Singapore. So it was a bit restricted for me. But for my brother, we moved to Singapore when he was a baby. He didn't really know any different. So it was good that they tried to recreate it.
That's probably pretty tricky to do.
Yeah.
So what were the expectations of you as a girl in Singapore? Were there any kind of expectations that you do one thing or the other, study one thing or the other?
Well, I guess the only expectation was that we had to be really, really good at school. One of the big reasons that my dad moved us there was so that we could have a better education and more opportunities at the end of it. So that was a non-negotiable growing up. You had to get good grades. If you didn't get good grades, my parents, they would do everything in their power to help get us there. My dad being an engineer, of course, he could help a lot with our schoolwork. And I remember as a kid, Sunday afternoons, he would iron his shirts for work. And for the duration that he was ironing, I had to sit in front of him and do math problems. And it was awful. It was every Sunday afternoon. I would dread it. And I think that's why at the age of 12, I learned to iron clothes. And I was like, look, I'm going to do the ironing. I'm not sitting there doing math problems.
I thought you were going to say you don't buy anything that needs to be ironed.
Yeah, no. But he'd pull out this book that had a lot of challenging math problems. And I'd sit there and I'd do them. And his idea was that in math and even in the science subjects, there was no reason not to get a full score, because he felt that there's only one right answer. I should be able to get there. It wasn't like English where it was subjective, if you write a good essay or a bad essay or if the teacher likes your work. But he kept on drilling that into me. There's only one right answer. That's all you have to do. You have to find the one right answer. It's, of course, harder to do than to say, but
yeah, finding 100% on each quiz and test is tricky.
Yeah, but that was the non-negotiable growing up. Is everything else, we didn't have to do a whole lot of chores. Everything was provided for me. I was a very lucky kid in that way. I didn't have to have a job, a part-time job outside of school. School kept us really busy in Singapore anyway, because you had to be good at school. You also had to be good at extracurriculars, because the way the system was, it factored into your final score when you're going on to junior college. It was part of the score that you got at the end of your 10th grade exams. So school kept us really, really busy. But our parents made it so that all we had to do was study and work hard.
Your job was school.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were some of your extracurriculars that you liked?
Oh, gosh. When I was this little kid, I think I just liked running around. So it was mostly some form of sport or other. Nothing with hand-eye coordination, because I sucked at that. I just could run. And then when I got to be a teenager, I was in the National Cadet Corps, which is like ROTC. I don't know if you guys have it.
I don't think it was so
pretty popular in Indiana. High school kids joined the ROTC, and they did military-like activities. I was a tomboy, and so that was my idea of fun, because we got to go camping and out in the jungle. It was tough, though. Not a lot of girls did it. I think in my school, there were 250 of us in my class, and probably 9 or 10 of us took part in that activity because it was hard. You know, it was physically hard, and it took up a lot of time. And we had uniforms that we had to keep ironed, and shoes that we had to keep polished. But the activities were a lot of fun. We had marksmanship, so we had to, you know, go to a shooting range and learn to shoot. And I think we were the only people, because you can't own guns privately in Singapore.
Yeah, not in Singapore.
for marksmanship, that was the only way that you could really learn to shoot, which I thought was fun. So I was a teenager, and we went camping a lot. We went orienteering, which was another activity that really, in Singapore, now that I look back on it, I'm amazed at how they created these pockets of wilderness for us to go to, because it's so built up. And I didn't realize that as a teenager, that all of these pockets of wilderness were there because somebody many years ago decided, you know what, that little piece of land is for the cadets or, you know, the army to do their exercises. It has to be kept that way, and they preserved forest areas, tracts of land for us to be able to do those activities, to go camping. And
yay for the forethought of conservationists.
Yeah. And in a tiny place. I mean, Singapore is really tiny. I was trying to explain it to one of my colleagues once, and I said that you could take the entire country of 5 million people and drop it into Baxter State Park and still have a whole bunch of land.
Oh, wow. So it's described online as a lozenge shaped island. Like, wow, that's small.
Yeah.
So one thing I'm really curious about is how you get from a high school in Singapore to a university in Indiana. Do you have counselors there that help you through that? How do you do that? How do you know where to go?
Okay, so they used to have these fairs. I don't know if they still have them, but when I was going to college, it was a big trend, if you could, to go to an overseas university, because in Singapore at the time we only had the National University of Singapore and the Nanyang Technological Universities. Both were really good schools, but of course for us kids it was really exciting to go overseas. So they used to have these big college fairs where people would come and they would set up booths and, you know, attempt to convince you that, you know, you had to go to their university. Over time you realize that a lot of the really good schools had no need to send recruiters overseas to try and find people to go. Since both Singapore and India are very academic-based societies, and so everybody knows the rankings of things, and so they knew which were the good schools and how highly they were ranked in whatever programs. And in the days when I was a teenager, I really wanted to be an astronaut because it was fascinating. And so I wanted to go into aerospace engineering, and the best public schools for that were Georgia Tech and Purdue. And so we have no sense of what America is like, and we don't know where these places are, or, you know, what if it's in the middle of a cornfield, as Purdue was, or in a city like Georgia Tech. We just knew that they were well-ranked, and for me, I was like, oh, astronauts came from Purdue. I want to go there. And that's just how I ended up there. I had no clue what Indiana even looked like when I filled in the forms.
It's a brave leap. I mean, you were just a girl.
Yeah, but it's easier to be brave at that age because you don't have a sense of danger. You never entertain the possibility that you might get bored because, you know, it's just not what you do. You bring the fun with you when you're a teenager.
Sounds like when you were 5 and 6 in India, honestly.
Yeah.
You just make your own fun as you go.
But that's how children are, you know. They don't not go to a place because they might get bored or not make friends.
A lot more trusting.
Plunge into it.
Right. Bring your creativity and have some fun.
Yeah.
You're listening to WMPG Southern Maine Community Radio, broadcasting from USM. I'm Kate Manahan, and this is New Mainers Speak. If you're just joining us, then welcome. Today I'm visiting with Mansi Joshi. Originally from India, then Singapore, and now is a Mainer working in her field as an engineer in Portland. So Mansi, you're in the field that disproportionately is dominated by men, one of being an engineer. You have mentioned being a member of the Society of Women Engineers, and this organization with 26,000 members is dedicated to service and education. I notice it also promotes engineering as a highly desirable career aspiration for women. And I wondered, how important is this society to you to have such an organization of women engineers?
Well, firstly, I do have to say I'm not a current dues-paying member of the society.
Okay, we'll let you slide.
I used to be, but I haven't really been as involved as I was when I was in Indiana. since I got here. But I think that it is, now that I've, you know, worked in the engineering field for a while, I think it is important to have a sense of community, because most of us end up being maybe the one female engineer, like I was at my previous job, or one of a handful of female engineers. And so it's good to have a sense of community, that there are others in your shoes. And so organizations like SWE often help you have this sense of community. And sometimes when they have events, you realize that, wow, just down the road, there's another woman working at, you know, another factory who's going through like some of the same things that I'm going through. And so that makes it a lot easier to get through.
I would imagine so. You know, when I looked into it, I was impressed with the really multi-pronged approach they use, both hosting girls and inviting them in to see what engineering is, working with college students. They're big on college campuses, helping mm-hmm. girls yeah. with scholarships and support, and then helping with placement and inspiration, and even holding awards for women engineers to give benchmarks and goals.
Yeah. I think it was they were very active when I was in college, and I think that they have to be, because there seems to be this kind of a mindset when I was in college that, you know, you went in as a freshman, you were enrolled in the School of Engineering or the College of Engineering, and then they made you take all these weed out classes, or what they called weed out classes, because there'd be a few hundred people. There were very, you know, basic engineering, like thermodynamics 1 or something. And the mindset was that these classes were made to be difficult, so that if you got through them, perhaps you were good enough to be an engineer. And if you weren't, if you didn't do well in those classes, you dropped out and went off to some other school. And I think that it's a very tough mindset, because, you know, you go into a class of, say, 500 engineers, you find that there's 30 other women there, and then you enter these weed out classes, which are a struggle for everybody unless you're used to studying 8 or 9 hours a day. And then you start questioning whether this is the thing for you. And when you look around and you know, if you see that there are other women and they're struggling along with you, then maybe you think, okay, everybody's having a tough time with this. But if you're on your own and you look around and you think, well, okay, I'm the only girl in this class, I'm having a hard time, I don't know if anybody else is, maybe I'm not meant to be here. And so the doubt creeps in, and I think having that community is essential, so that when the doubt creeps in, as it does for everybody, you realize that you're not the only one having that doubt.
Absolutely.
These classes are made to be hard for everybody.
I think maybe the most important thing in the whole world is to know that there are other people like oneself, whether yeah. it's who had a parent that died recently, or who want to be something that nobody else seems to want to be. You know, it's good to have that real support, real reflections.
Yeah.
What kind of help do you think might be important to women to help them move towards studying engineering?
Well, what I found when I was going to engineering school in Indiana was that the people who are the most comfortable being there, not saying that they were the best in class, just the people who were the most comfortable being there were all the farm boys who grew up repairing their tractors, or, you know, the guys who grew up working on their cars as teenagers because their dad got them a beater car that they had to fix up before they could drive it. And that experience at a very young age gave them some confidence that they could fix anything, that they were hands-on people, they could think outside the box, they could make do with what they had, and they could fix things. And they often excelled at engineering school because they had the innate confidence that if it's broken, they could do something about it. Even though they weren't necessarily the ones who got the good grades. I think the kids that got the best grades were the ones who were just really good at math and studying. But they're the most confident, all-rounded engineers. And I think that that's one of the things that we have to try and inculcate in young girls. You know, when, let's say you're in a family and there's a male child and a female child, and the dad will often take the male child to go work on the car. Well, take the girl as well. You know, she can learn to use a wrench, and it goes a long ways in developing their confidence. Even if, you know, you're a woman who can change your own light bulb, you're like, I can work with this machine. It's not this intimidating black box. It's something that could be figured out. I think that would be a really key step if, they were given the opportunity and the little learnings that boys have tinkering around.
Did you have any of that yourself?
Unfortunately, not a whole lot, because growing up in Singapore, we lived in a little apartment. My dad didn't have a car, so we didn't have a garage to tinker around in. But we'd often wait for something around the house to break down or my mother to complain that it wasn't working right. And then we'd pounce on it like vultures and start taking it apart. And my mother would often say, you know, if you're taking it apart, you have to put that back. Like, yeah, we'll just buy a new one if it doesn't work after we attempt to fix it.
Well, that's great. You had a passion for it even before you got going.
Yeah, I wasn't very good at it, but I tried.
That's good. And do you like being an engineer? How does that sit with you as a profession?
I do like being an engineer. I like math. I like playing with numbers. And I really like designing something or, you know, doing the math. We work with pumps, and so, you know, you design a pump, you have a bunch of numbers, and then to actually have the parts in your hand and put it together, which never goes right, but when it does, it's very satisfying, and then to see things perform and to realize that the number crunching that you do actually translates to a real-world result is very, very satisfying. And I think that's why most engineers are in it, is to go from coming up with something on paper and actually seeing it run is probably the most satisfying thing for an engineer. And so I think for me, I can't imagine doing anything else. I guess a part of it would be now that it's kind of become a habit after years of doing it. But I just can't picture myself doing anything else. Yeah, so I do like it. It's a daily challenge, but when we manage to fix something or come up with something new that actually works, there's nothing like it.
I bet that would be very satisfying.
Yeah.
If you were allowed to use your skills to their fullest potential, what might you like to engineer or contribute to the world?
That's a difficult question. I couldn't tell you if a thing, but I guess what bugs me when I have time to contemplate it, I guess, is that a lot of humanity's needs are not being met. Very basic needs, like for water and shelter and food, are not being met, but at the same time, we've got a lot of technology to do a lot of really cool things. And I guess in an ideal world, I would like to somehow use knowledge of the really cool advanced technology to help with some of the very basic problems that we're facing in the world today. I don't know how to bridge that gap or what magic invention will do it, but I guess when I have time to sit back and think about it, engineers over the centuries, their job has been to make life easier for people, whether it's to get from point A to point B, or to make it easier to come up with skyscrapers,
or build just an aqueduct.
Yeah, or just, you know, just make your life easier in the home. Their engineers' jobs have always been to make life easier, and so we're doing it for a good chunk of humanity. Well, what about the rest?
It's a really great question. How do you think your field might be different if there were more gender equity? If there were more women in there with these ideas of using technology and our smarts to help everyone in the whole?
Oh, boy. That's a hard question.
Not that all women would necessarily want that, too, but and plenty of men want that, too, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But what would it be like?
I guess that is a really hard question, because at the end of the day, I think male and female engineers really want the same thing. You know, we're always balancing the technological efficacy of something with its safety and its cost and all of that. So at the end of the day, I think we both want the same outcome. I guess the workplace might be a little different if... I think women tend to collaborate more. And I don't know if that's just what, you know, the media or literature kind of tells you, or if it's really true, but it would help if we were collaborating rather than competing. I don't say within my own team, I think we're very collaborative within my team, but in terms of across businesses or across different functions, my idea is that women tend to think more of, okay, how can we have a good outcome for everybody versus a good outcome for me. So that might be a good thing for the engineering workplace.
I would think so. For the whole world, maybe.
The whole world, yeah.
I read a wonderful little article about Google and how Google's made more of an effort than other companies to make sure they're getting more women in, because they need the perspective. They were finding that they were really reaching their target audiences of young men, but they weren't necessarily reaching everyone. They need the diversity of opinions and insights.
Yeah, I think leadership styles too are very different between men and women. So having a balance of both would help any workplace, really.
Yeah, the same article indicated that really most of the hiring was being done with panels of men, and they were all finding people that they liked that looked like them to come into these jobs, and that was a suggestion of one of the things that you could do differently is have some women on the hiring team and always have at least one woman candidate.
That's funny you should say that, because the place that I worked for, my first job before I moved here, I ended up interviewing for them because we had these engineering job fairs at Purdue, and lots of companies would come there. In fact, I think it's probably the biggest engineering job fair in the country. It might be over like 250 employers would come in, and they'd set up a booth, and you could talk to not only HR managers, but I remember talking to a Boeing program manager there. And it was this company just had all women behind a booth, and I walked up to them, and I was like, You don't have any men. And they're like, well, we're mostly from HR, but we've got a couple of our women engineers here. We just somehow just ended up sending all women to recruit. And I started chatting with them, and you know, the engineer who was there and I had, we of course, you know, I was graduating Purdue and she'd been to Purdue, so we hit it off and started chatting and got along really well. And I had an interview with them. Eventually, ended up getting the job. But I think I walked up to the booth because I was like, they were all wearing red T-shirts, so they were very easy to see. But it was all women behind the counter, and it kind of fascinated me.
We want to know we can belong, right? At a very primal human level.
Yeah.
And when we see ourselves, we fit right in. Wow, that's a pretty great story. So, I'm so sorry we're running out of time. I want to keep going and talking with you. I'm sure your parents are very proud of you and all the work you're doing here. Bet they miss you, though. Are they still in Singapore?
They are still in Singapore, and they do miss me.
Oh, so thank you so much for coming on today, Mansi, and thank you for all the work you're doing here in Portland to make things work better.
Oh, thank you. I'm very happy to be here. I really enjoy Maine.
Do you like the coast as much as you thought you might?
Oh, it's beautiful. It was, it's more beautiful than the pictures, really, which is all I had seen before I moved here.
So. You are brave. After a few announcements, I would love it if you would introduce the Bollywood song that you picked out for today's closing.
Okay.
Mansi was formerly a WMPG DJ with a program playing Bollywood music, which you listeners may remember if you are early morning people. But first, I'd like to thank you for listening. Please join us each Sunday from noon to 12:30 for similar interviews with diverse members of our community. I'm Kate Manahan in the studio with my guest, Mansi Joshi. Joshi. You've been listening to New Mainers Speak. Stay tuned to WMPG for Cruz del Sur up next. We'll close today's program with some Bollywood music, all picked out for you. What can you tell us about this song?
This is called La La Bulia. It's by Johnny Z and DJ K, who later went on to become Stereo Nation, this big dance band from the UK.
Oh, great. Well, we'll look forward to it. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
Hey! 9-4-7, 11-24-7, cool!